A major explosion rocks Benghazi, Libya, exactly a year after U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Joining us to dissect this and other breaking news headlines is our guest expert, Rahul Mahajan. He's a sociologist and a news analyst and has written the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Good morning, Rahul.
Good morning.
Well, now 12 years after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, D.C., and 1 year after an attack on a U.S. embassy in Benghazi, a foreign ministry building in Benghazi, Libya, was partially destroyed today by an explosion. The attack is part of an increasing trend of violence targeting Libya's security forces and judiciary. Rahul, the brief U.S.-NATO bombing campaign in Libya 2 years ago that helped topple Muammar Gaddafi could be the most recent model for what Obama would like to do in Syria if indeed the attempts with Russia to thwart an attack fail, this brief targeted campaign that they carried out in Libya. But if today's Libya is any indication, what sort of future could Syria have after a U.S. bombing campaign?
Well, I mean, clearly Libya is in a state of anarchy, chaos, and local tyrannies. And Benghazi alone, the single city, has had more than 60 political assassinations since the civil war ended. So that's an extraordinary rate. I mean, the number of murders obviously is far greater. And for that matter, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen are not in good shape either. I don't think any of these countries, however, compares to the situation in Syria with an ongoing war. I do think that the situation in Libya is very much on the minds of the Obama administration, and the fact that those who have sort of emerged into power in Libya are not perhaps the most congenial people to the United States has a lot to do with the fact that they are probably not planning a campaign that would actually significantly help the rebels to win, but rather one that would most likely simply prolong the stalemate, because the rebels are now losing and an attack on the other side will actually make the violence go on longer.
In New York City, a mayoral candidate championed by unions and progressives, Bill de Blasio, appears to have won the Democratic Party's primary election, which means that he faces Republican candidate Joe Loda in a general election this fall. Given the current Republican mayor Michael Bloomberg's unpopular policies in support of the NYPD's overreach on things like racial profiling and surveillance and heavy-handedness in general, Rahul, could a win this fall by de Blasio mean a very different future for the nation's financial and cultural epicenter?
Well, I think the win of de Blasio in the primary is very encouraging because, after Anthony Weiner's meltdown, his biggest opponent, Christine Quinn, is considerably more conservative and considerably closer to Michael Bloomberg politically and in terms of the issues. So the fact that he won is a good sign. What the question is, how much is it going to tack back to the right and towards the sort of authoritarian neoliberalism of a Michael Bloomberg in order to try to win New York? This is the kind of politician I instinctively distrust. It's the last guy who talked about, he talks about two New Yorks. The last guy who talked about the two Americas was John Edwards. So he's come out of nowhere. He's now the Democratic nominee. The big question is he going to remain true to the principles that he was espousing when he ran for the nomination?
And finally, the city of Richmond here in California has just approved a resolution to enable the seizing of properties using eminent domain in order to save homes with underwater mortgages and other financial problems. The Richmond City Council voted 4-3 to approve a collaboration with the group Mortgage Resolution Partners in a move that private mortgage and real estate companies are loudly denouncing. Richmond is one of the poorest cities in California. It also happens to have one of the most progressive mayors, Gail McLaughlin, who championed the resolution that passed. Rahul, other cities like San Bernardino here in Southern California attempted such a move and failed. If Richmond has successfully now passed this resolution and can actually use this method to help people stay in their homes, could it spark a trend in other cities?
Well, this kind of action is certainly very much being thought about. There's a particular issue that, it's one thing to talk about mortgages that are owned by a bank and dealing with the bank, making a deal to have them write down some of the debt, get things sort of more in tune with the market value, a move that usually will actually increase the bank's, the worth of the loan to the bank, even though its nominal value is smaller. But for securitized mortgages, it's much more difficult because you've got these things spliced and diced and parceled out through God knows how many different owners in different places with very different agendas. And that's why the use of eminent domain is one possibility. It's questionable, certainly. The federal government, the Federal Housing Finance Authority, has already come out strongly against it. But, of course, the interests of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are very much like the interests of other mortgage companies. The big question, I think, is whether this is exactly the best way to do it. Something like this is a good idea, but the particular contours of this plan suggest that it may be in part a way for mortgage resolution partners to use the authority of the city government to make a lot of money on the cheap.
Well, we'll certainly follow the story and see whether it plays out that way. Rahul, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Great to be with you.
Rahul Mahajan is our Daily News Flash guest expert. He is a sociologist and news analyst and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond.